Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 18th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today he will be continuing his series on spirit-born creation. Today's session number is 4 and is titled, The Gifts of Darkness. Let's listen in.
My name is Larry Rasmussen and this is a series this week entitled Spirit-Born Creation, or Creation-Born Spirit. And what I have tried to do this week is take some of the non-human elements of nature and ask how they might inform us about a way in which we now need to live given the cumulative human impact on the non-natural world. But there is, as I mentioned yesterday, a theological assumption back of this, and that theological assumption is that non-human elements of nature in fact bear the Spirit of God. They are where God is present among us, as just as God is also present among us as human beings who are to be bearers of God to one another. So I've been looking at trees, and now tonight we're going to do darkness, and on Saturday we'll do water, because I think we all need to learn a way of being in the world that takes clues from patterns and rhythms in nature. It has been typical of modernity to treat non-human nature in utterly utilitarian terms and see ourselves over against it and in not needing to take into account its own claims for its own renewal and regeneration. We're paying a price for that. We'll pay a greater price for that in the future. And a long process now of learning again that we are members of a larger community of life whose own rhythms make claims upon us and the way we live is part of what this enterprise is about. Tonight I want to talk about the gifts of darkness. It's a rhythm, a pattern in nature. When we talked about trees, we were visiting the tree of life as one of the most ecumenical of all religious symbols. One could do the same thing with the sacred mountain or with rivers. These are constant reference points in the spiritual lives of cultures. With darkness, it's a different situation. There, I'm asking, how is something which has not been regarded as a positive symbol by and large in most cultures an instructive one for us? So, my assumption back of that is that we also live in a time when we need to find new ways of symbolizing the world around us. And I think the gifts of darkness, or the darkness as a positive notion, is one of those possibilities. There aren't enough copies of the book of hymns and songs, a worship book called Gather, in this room for us all to look on. But there are just a few around, and I'm going to ask a favor of the people who have one close at hand. What I want to do tonight to start with is just to bring to your attention a hymn, number 550 in this volume, Gather, which takes darkness as a positive theme. And the title of the hymn is Joyful is the Dark. Tomorrow night at Vespers, we're going to worship in the dark and around the theme of the gifts of darkness. And this is a hymn that we're going to be singing there. What I would like to do then now, there are five verses and there should be four of these around, 5:15.
And I will read the first verse, and then I will ask each of the persons who has a copy to read a verse in turn. And what... Oh, right. We're gonna have to make up 15 verses. That'll be the task of those of you from verse 6 on. I didn't know we had more copies in here. Oh, all right. Well, then those of you who can see one, please follow along. Those of you who cannot, simply listen, and all of us are to be paying attention to the same thing. Namely, what is the image of darkness here? What is associated with darkness? How does it play religiously, spiritually, morally, or in a way simply to tell a story? So, either follow along with eyes or ears or both. Joyful is the dark, holy hidden God, rolling cloud of night beyond all naming. Majesty in darkness, energy of love, word in flesh, the mystery proclaiming. Would you take the second, one of you?
Joyful is the dark, spirit of the deep, winging wildly o'er the world's creation. Silken sheen of midnight, plumage black and bright, swooping with the beauty of a raven.
Yeah.
Joyful is the dark, shadowed stable floor, angels flicker, God on earth confessing, as with exultation, Mary giving birth, hails the infant cry of need and blessing.
Janice?
Joyful is the dark, coolness of the tomb, waiting for the wonder of the morning. Never was the midnight touched by dread and gloom. Darkness was the cradle of the dawn.
Coming around, the last verse, one of you.
Joyful is the dark, depth of love divine, roaring, looming thundercloud of glory, holy, haunting beauty, living, loving God. Hallelujah, sing and tell the story.
It's going to be fun to sing this tomorrow night. What are the associations of dark with darkness in these verses?
Hidden God.
Yeah, the hidden God, the first line. And rolling cloud of night beyond all naming. One of the persistent themes in Christian faith is that God is beyond knowing and beyond naming. That's part of faith is the great unknowing. That this is the ineffable one. This is the unnameable one. This is the one beyond all naming. But nonetheless, we insist upon trying, and we use all manner of images. And I really like this one for naming the holy hidden God, rolling cloud of night beyond all naming. Other associations, darkness.
Mystery.
Mm-hmm. There is something about it. In the darkness, there is a sense of mystery that isn't associated with the light where you can see all the details.
Darkness coming creation, birth.
Yeah. The darkness of the womb. I'm going to say tomorrow night as part of the Vespers that all new life comes from darkness. The darkness of the womb, dark soil, the darkness of the tomb. It's from darkness that all new life emerges, and it's picked up here with the creation. Yeah.
And so pain, Mary giving birth, certainly not the easiest thing in the world. And then after the infant crying, we need a blessing. But creation comes out of pain, I think, also.
Yes. Yeah. It's the look, I guess in that verse, is it shadowed stable floor? The darkness is associated with Mary giving birth to Jesus. It's, what is it, angels flicker, God on earth confessing. It's in the darkness, or it's in the shadows that Jesus is born.
In that same line, I think, it's not really specific to darkness, but it speaks of cry of need and blessing. The darkness captures both the danger.
Yeah, a little bit like the pain and the joy, maybe. Coupled.
Yeah, to die is not easy, whether it's a seed getting itself or
yeah.
But it comes to life, but she's really another baptismal image.
Yeah. Please, just go ahead, speak up.
Temporary dimension, I think, is important here. Most of these dark periods are temporary.
Ah, yes. Something follows the darkness. Yeah. Yeah. And where is the line that... darkness was the cradle of the dawning. Yeah, the temporary character of it, or the passing character of it, the prelude character of it, yeah.
Majesty in darkness.
Yeah, what does that mean?
In Carlsbad Caverns, they turn out all the lights. And the first time they claim that you were seen total darkness.
Huh.
And then, way off in the distance, they start to play on an organ, Rock of Ages.
Whoa.
And it is unbelievable.
Huh. Thanks for bringing that up. That graphically describes majesty and darkness. I saw that phrase and I liked it, but I didn't know why. Now I know why.
They turn on the lights far, far away, way down, and then another light.
Yeah.
You just barely see it in the dark.
Yeah. I remember one time Julius Nyerere, who was president of Tanzania at the time of its independence and for a while thereafter, talking about the vocation of the new nation. And as a U.S. American, I remembered when he spoke, I remembered the image of the city set on the hill in the darkness. But I was completely enamored with Nyerere's image was a candle atop Kilimanjaro in the darkness. Kilimanjaro is in Tanzania, but that is a little bit like the flicker in Carlsbad Caverns way off there. I thought to myself, now, do we have the humility to see ourselves as a tiny little candle atop Kilimanjaro as a kind of direction? What other things in here? Yeah, Susan.
Twice there's deep and depth. In the second stanza, joyful is about spirit of the deep, who is later identified with the raven instead of the dove, which is interesting.
Yeah, the raven is
and in the fire. Fifth stanza, depth of love divine, to me that is a beautiful image of darkness. Love so deep that goes down so deep that not even light reaches it, but less it deep with darkness. That love could be so deep that its steadfastness is most visible when everything else cannot be seen. When we can't see, when the light that would allow us to see is there, how the trust of this love that's so deep finally is in the dark.
Nice.
We fear the darkness.
And in this fear, there is also the majesty of the mystery and the awesomeness of God.
Yeah. Now those often get those can be coupled. Yeah.
What is kind of striking in this hymn, however, at one line, which is a counterpoint, so to speak, is this line: "Never was that midnight touched by dread and gloom." I mean, very often we do associate darkness with dread and gloom, and there are good reasons for that. But it's a striking line to say, "Never was that midnight touched by dread and gloom. Darkness was the cradle of the dawn," as was pointed out earlier, a prelude.
Isn't darkness also associated with rest and renewal?
Ah, yeah. Yes. Rest and renewal.
We speak of fear of death. Attended a funeral not that long ago, in which the pastor used that as a reference of death as rest and renewal.
Uh-huh.
And Paul talks about death as sleep.
Yeah.
And therefore, why should he fear?
There seems to be darkness, a loss of control for us. I'm not being able to get around that. Think about that. Not recently, I took a member of our congregation home to her apartment, and she is blind. And she walked in without turning on any lights. And I couldn't walk.
Why bother?
Require her to leave me.
Yeah.
I led her to the door, but to get into her place.
Sure. Other associations, that's great.
Peggy has a poem that implies that much of God's work is done in the darkness.
Yeah.
Mm. The poem is called Sleep and begins as God speaking, "I don't like the man who doesn't sleep." And then it goes on to point out how you assume that God isn't working. God is working while you sleep. Go on to sleep. God's going to take care of it in the darkness.
One of the associations of darkness is a kind of fecundity. And that there is something quietly, importantly happening at work in the darkness. Yeah.
With the beauty of a raven, and Native American thought a raven is magic.
Oh.
And also I think of spirit, maybe Holy Spirit, dark spirit, spirit of the universe, when I associate that with raven. And this hymn has sort of an ancient feeling to it, because of some of the symbolism, and also just the way you're talking about birth and associating certain, there's a female feminine aspect of the conscious script of this hymn that goes a little bit beyond or before Christianity to me, some of the symbolism.
I was struck by the image of the raven, not just because it wasn't a dove, but because a famous painting by George O'Keefe comes to mind of black ravens in the sky, which I think in that painting are images of death. Actually, but it's a very imposing presence that the raven brings, and here. It was a different take on that, but I didn't know that about the Native American association of raven and magic. Yeah.
The line that I kind of looked at and thought about for a while, the roaring, looming thundercloud of glory. Having grown up on the Great Plains, the thundercloud was definitely something that, you know, significant in your life, and here you think of it as Thundercloud of Glory.
Yeah. Now, is that a, do you think of thunderclouds in that way?
No.
No.
No. No.
But you do think of them as majestic.
Right.
Yeah. My wife is from Nebraska, and we both love New York City, and we've lived in cities in the East for 30 years. The one thing that she misses are the thunderstorms on the plane. But and I thought she was a little crazy. When she used to go out, when we did live in the countryside for a brief period of time, and just go outside and watch all of this portentous weather moving in on you. I mean, I said, you'd probably be happy if you spotted a tornado forming over there. She enjoys, for some reason or another, the rolling thunder clouds of glory. There's something majestic about darkness.
In college, I spent a summer in Washington, and then went back to Minnesota in the fall, and I remember the first thunder clouds I saw. Here they are.
Yeah. Just as a, no, please.
They mean renewal also. I guess it brings rain. And
that's right.
Renewal.
Yep. We wouldn't live without them. And neither would anything else. Just to, if you don't already know, Brian Wren, the person who composed this hymn. He's an English composer who does a lot of wonderful hymns, and one of his own efforts these days is to range widely among possible images for talking about the Spirit of God in our time, including some wonderfully feminine images in a lot of his hymns. Okay, are there still other associations? Now let me shift this just a little bit here and just open it up from the hymn itself to your associations with darkness from whatever source. What has darkness connoted and denoted for you? Silence?
Sleep.
Yeah, silence and
please.
Sleep, I think.
Sleep.
Peace.
And sleep.
Yeah. Yes.
Dreaming.
Dreaming the darkness. Yeah.
Transformation, kind of a journaling cauldron of potion for major changes in my life. The darkness, although very, very painful, incredible, you know, changes soul level from the darkness.
Now, St. John of the Cross speaks positively about darkness because it is the journey of the place of the journey of the soul, often including painful changes, but transformative ones that are themselves vital to life.
Well, excitement, kind of downtown nightclubs.
Yeah.
Nothing takes off until the sun goes.
Nothing's happening.
Like
yeah, nothing's happening until it gets dark, right? Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. That's right. That's when things sort of start winding up. There's a little music, lights here and there, and some dancing.
But it here's my town.
Nothing.
I remember a few times, a few days I was in Paris, and it was not really that interesting to look at during the day. I mean, something more, but when the lights went up, because the sun went down, then it just seemed like a different city, it's exciting.
that's right.
Yes, please.
A darkness, for me, represents a wonderful backdrop for bright colors and bright light. That it produces the sharpest possible contrast.
Oh.
The lure of Borealis.
Mm-hmm. I guess in the dark sky. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love the beginning of darkness. I love watching the sunset and then seeing the stars, which is the light coming out of the darkness.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite times of day.
Yeah.
In the darkness. There,
I think it was Jeff who mentioned that prayers one evening at Vespers, saying that in Judaism, prayer time is sunrise and sunset. Those, the rhythm of the day is such that it's given over, as it were, to awe or taking notice, gratitude. It's a kind of natural time for prayer. And prayer corresponds somehow to the rhythms of nature at that time of day.
The darkness also has the brown shades, the dim light, and the beeping of the intravenous machine in depth.
Mm.
That is part of that too.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe it's because the hymn itself connotes carries images of darkness that are positively rendered, but I'm a little surprised. I haven't heard more of darkness as not only death, but kind of foreboding, that is often associated with that fear you mentioned.
And along that line, aren't the psychologists telling us that when the children do paintings and paint in black, that's a sign of disturbance and fear and
when you're sick, you can't hardly wait for the morning to come. There's a relief when light comes.
Yes, won't the night ever be over?
You always feel better in the morning.
We've done sailing, ocean sailing, long passages, and I always dreaded the night because it was a long, long night, and you had to sit there in the cockpit and make sure you were sailing the right course and avoiding oncoming ships. And so I always dreaded when that sun went down.
I have a similar image of camping on in Arizona, Utah, the border, and we camp out in the open and we go there. And night comes, and it's really dark. And not only does it come, but the bats come.
The bats.
The bats.
Yeah.
The bats.
Yeah. Maybe a few priorities.
Yeah.
Yes. A bat swooping in the dark, you know, where it's just barely light enough to see it, can just scare you out of it. Yeah. You had your hand up.
We just don't see dark in our day-to-day like we used to.
No.
We've always got street lights. And, I think we don't see darkness as maybe our parents.
No, that's one of the reasons why I want us to talk about it, is because a lot of us, despite Daryl's love of dark and cities, and that's when things sort of get interesting. For a lot of us who are urban, especially those of us who are urban creatures, we become increasingly alienated from the patterns of nature. And I think that alienation contributes to our misuse, or the ease with which we simply and utterly use nature. You know, there isn't much resonance between our own bodies and the rest of nature, to which our bodies are supposed to be attuned.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Alvin, we talked the other day about our cabin on Blewett Pass, and we have no electricity or anything there, so we do have kerosene lights, but it always strikes me when we go over, particularly in the winter time, and it gets dark very quickly through the mountains, it's dark, and I always think about exactly this issue of in times when there was no electricity and people were on the farm and so forth, when it got dark, except for the few kerosene lights, they went to bed. And that was the pattern of their life. You stopped your work for the most part when it was dark, and then as soon as it was light, you were up and going. And setting life by that pattern must be a very wonderful thing in a sense, rather than the somewhat artificial way that we set it because we have this life.
Without darkness, we can't appreciate the universe. That is, we aren't able to study distant bodies. And in the darkness, we are able to feel this awe and inspired. You just, the cabin, when it's dark, you look up, and you can just spend the whole night just looking at it and imagining and dreaming and studying, if you will.
I hadn't thought about that. That our very sense of the universe itself,
right,
and the kind of awesomeness that comes to us in moments when we begin to have, in our own feeble ways, some sense of the dimensions, only is possible because of the darkness. If it were light all the time on Earth, we would probably confuse our little patch of estate, real estate, with the totality.
There are a number of writers in the analysis of resource issues who talk about the advent of electricity, and it's allowing us to conquer darkness as being a very real key to the arrogance with which we now treat the world around us. Another similar one being, for example, the ability to conquer heat with air conditioning and the impact that has had, the arrogance that brings to the development of our world.
It makes us think that we have a world of our own making and it can be good, and that the Earth is a spaceship and we're the crew, you know? I mean, it's that kind of arrogance that nature is there at our disposal for whatever it is we have in mind to design. So the propensity, and it's a stronger propensity among men than it is among women, but the propensity toward to see life in terms of control is in part because we're not subject to these recurring patterns. We can substitute light 24 hours a day for any darkness, or we can substitute air at 72 degrees and have air at 72 degrees all year round.
Yeah. Is there something wrong with that?
Well, I mean, that's a serious question. What I'm saying is that...
I meant to be serious.
I know. I'm taking it as a serious question. And what I'm saying is that I think it has very much played into a picture of ourselves and the rest of life as one in which nature is, in a sense, plastic. It's over against us. It's infinitely malleable for us and at our disposal. We are the subject, it is the object. And then that tends to put us in a position where we see ourselves lifted as a species apart from the rest of life. So you get us as a species, controlling species apart, and the rest of it as stuff at our disposal. And it's precisely that relationship of subject to object, object as at the disposal of subject, which has brought us to the predicament that industrial societies face. So I do think that there are strong negative implications.
I guess the corollary would be, what is progress?
I think we know what progress is. What's happening now is that we're living with the downside of progress. Because we have treated nature essentially as free goods, never asking what it required for its own renewal and regeneration as a part of what we understood progress to be, and never asking what it would cost to return life to a position where it is self-sustaining. Progress never asked either about the origins of those free goods or about their destiny. In New York City on 42nd Street, the New Amsterdam Theater is recently bought by Disney, is undergoing a renovation. And in the foyer of the New Amsterdam Theater, there's a damsel there with a ship in her arms, and back of her filling the space are the rays of the sun and stars, and she is progress. That's how she's named there. But now you can actually, she's just grimy. I mean, in the surface of the damsel herself, you can just sort of see the downside of our times. And I think that's kind of emblematic. For a while, we're going to be paying a very, very high price for progress, because we didn't ask about what the cost is to the very community of life upon which any progress depends. Let me try something for a little while. And just share with you something that I've tried to put together on the gifts of darkness. Much of it picks up on what you've already passed along, and it's just a continuation of that. It's a little bit the teacher, the languages, but most of it's the language of meditation and contemplation. And this is from a book, if you want to order it, here's the order for it. This is from a book in Christian ethics, but part of my contention in the book itself is that the language of ethics is not only the language of moral exhortation, the language of parents, the language of pastors doing catechetics, the language of teachers, the language of moral instruction and moral exhortation. And I don't think the language of ethics is only the language of analysis and argument, what are the proper premises leading to the proper conclusion about what we ought to do. Or even the language of Christian ethics isn't only the language of locating ourselves in the story, the language of moral narrative, forming of character. All of those are languages of ethics, but another language of Christian ethics is the more meditative, contemplative language in which a space is opened up in us, in our souls, to receive the world around us. And that helps shape the kinds of persons we are
and the kinds of persons we might become. So this is this and tomorrow night at Vespers is intended actually to be a language of Christian ethics. That is, it's intended to be that kind of language which shapes human character and even human conscience, a way of being in the world, a way of life, which is what finally an ethic is about. So just receive it in that form, and then there may be some time for discussion afterwards. Children's ways can be arresting. You never see three-year-olds pull their chairs up to the kitchen table, grab a mug of milk, and reminisce about the good old days. But they do love to indulge in non-stop conversation. Often it's at bedtime when the parental directive is go to sleep, and the child's agenda is some perplexity left over from the day just past, or some anticipation of the day just ahead. Now, I don't remember any longer the hoary details of those conversations, but I do remember verbatim our son's words as I often stepped from bedside to door. "Okay, Dad, you can turn on the dark now." Because we get the symbols wrong, we get reality wrong. Light means life, we think, and darkness means foreboding, danger, death with all its authority. Yet since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, light has ghastly meaning, as it has since flames lit the night sky in the serene countryside near Auschwitz. Lucifer, demonic prince of the netherworld, comes as an angel of light. And even in New York City, where I live, in love with light, as all great cities are, light all night is exhausting. Civilization means, literally, city ways. And city ways do their best to ban and banish darkness. Everything is throbbing energy 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Our adrenaline is pumped, but this is life without respite, without solitude, without peace, without Sabbath. The children's instruction would never occur to us. "Okay, Dad, it's time to turn on the dark now." So, what I want then is a kind of, or what I'm undertaking is kind of meditation on darkness in a city, in a world that will have none of it. I mean, we're kind of running counter to civilization itself. There's a kind of conspiracy against darkness and its gifts that spans the globe. I don't know if you've ever seen those pictures from space of the planet at night, and you can tell the outlines of civilization by the lights showing up on the continent. In fact, you can outline countries many times, or at least coastlines by the lights, because 30% of all human beings live within 30 miles of a coast. Did you know that? That's where we're concentrated. That's got nothing to do with souls see in the dark. I have a Quaker friend who has a sticker on her refrigerator door, something akin to the psalmist, "Be still and know that I am God," only her sticker says, "In case of emergency, keep quiet." Well, life is something of an emergency now, and it's long since time to consider the gifts of stillness and darkness, augmented with a few candles now and then. Maybe some of you remember Wendell Berry's old farmer who, unable to walk any further, stopped at a spring and beheld, quote, wonders, little wonders of a great wonder. He just looked into the life in the spring. Well, Berry's preceding sentence is this: and it comes to Matt once more by stillness. He has passed across into the inward presence of the place, wild inward presence of the place. Stillness, yes, but also by darkness do we pass over into the wild inward presence of things, and by still darkness most of all. Because darkness cleans the soul, especially darkness in the mountains, on the hills, and in the woods, or the desert. Shadows rise there. We get this reality backward, too. Contrary to what we think, shadows don't fall at eventide. They rise. Go and watch what happens in autumn. Let the trees teach you as the sun falls. You'll find nature there in a painting mood, as Adam Leopold once said of a river at eventide. First, grace will creep silently across the grass, itself already refreshed at the thought of sleep and new dew. Then grace, as shadow, will, more gently than any other movement in all of nature, slowly climb the tree trunk. Close the door of the woodpecker's hole for awaited rest, and pause just long enough to let the blazing crown of red and gold leaves strut their stuff before the night and another hard day of big changes. Shadows rise. What falls are the encumbrances of the soul. Darkness is also dreaming time. Somebody mentioned that earlier. We daydream, of course, on the subway, at the bus stop, in a meeting. But daydreaming runs a poor second. It's not the real thing. True dreams come by night, when whales dream, and swallows, and angels, and the spirit. This, too, is grace time. In this grace of dream time and darkness, the soul is restored. If there were only light, the soul's restless dreams would soon flame out. Darkness restores the soul because in the night, all things are reconciled. They all merge. They all join the same soft, dark color. They cease their predation. They rest quietly in praise. In darkness, especially candlelit darkness, we all stop trying to outshout one another. Ever notice how at night, as it gets darker, people's voices go down? Around the campfire or wherever? Voices grow hushed with the stillness of the dark. We listen more carefully and far better when we are still together in the dark. Often eventide is the only time of day when we even hear the Spirit, God's soft breath and gentle breeze, which is the sure presence of the divine. It's the time that rage subsides, and we can be one body. Sometimes darkness is the only time we even notice sounds as silent as dove's feet, or the pacifying whispers of serenity. Otherwise, even hope is drowned out by rattling jackhammers and a million other noises of empires at work. But when with the dark, they cease most of the time. Not in my neighborhood, but most of the time in most neighborhoods. Eternity then steals a visit, and the soul recovers. In fact, it is the silent working of life itself that comes by night. In the growing darkness, nature and the spirit's closeness are felt even on the skin, and are palpable in the musty air of evening. The breath of life the trees breathe out, I breathe in. The breath I breathe out, the soil breathes in. The breath the soil breathes out, the birds breathe in. The breath the birds breathe out, the water breathes in. Life is one. And this mighty presence, this truly mighty God, is quietly praised in the darkness by the ruach of life, the spirit, the breath of life, that no one even notices by day. Two, darkness teaches. It teaches true place. We are not masters of all that we survey, or even captains of our own tormented souls. We are simple little creatures alive with other simple little creatures in a cosmos too colossal to catch, except perhaps in the small twinklings of distant suns, a wrinkle or two in time, and whatever tiny portion of the unfathomable imagination of God we are able to borrow for a passing moment. Darkness teaches the utter giftedness, even strangeness, of life, and comes to us without earning or requirement, status or striving of our own. We are simply justified in God's reclaiming of creation, justified in the order of being itself, and saved with all the rest of it, together. The cottonwoods, Los Alamos, maples, jays, all creepy crawling things, things visible and things invisible. This is nothing other than the gift of God and the feast of life. It is best known when darkness reconciles us all in the beauty of blackness and we little candlelights. Now, I love New York City. I love its energy. I love its wild collection of peoples. I'm glad to walk crowded sidewalks. But only when the gifts of darkness now and again surround and embrace, when darkness quells all compulsion to do more and to have more, when shadows and stillness let being simply, quietly be. For we, more than others, have made life an emergency now. The planet reels from centuries of trying to make it light and white, fast, packaged, and marketable. So darkness saves, or at least tries to save, all who've been wrecked by 500 years of manic commerce and a half a century of development. Trees and darkness save, as in Langston Hughes' poem, Dream Variation. To whirl and to dance till the white day is done, then rest at cool evening beneath a tall tree, while night comes on gently, dark like me. Rest at pale evening, a tall slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me. What's the humble point? The humble point is that living means lighting a light in the darkness, not against it. Let me just finish and then we have some time for your reflection. The author, Ezahim Kohach, has a nice line. He says, an argument leads to a conclusion, an evening does not. Not only an evening, however, but any number of other rhythms and forms of nature that need our receptive attention for a kind of ethic of kinship with all things. A mountain doesn't have a conclusion either, at least not like an argument or a story. Nor does water, a bird's song, a high mesa, a festive meal, or our bodies. And one of the sure tasks of Christian ethics now for us is creatively to symbolize anew the wonder of life around us and to listen to the guidance of the little wonders of Matt the Farmer and Wendell Berry's story, the little wonders of the great wonder of Earth. What's at stake? What's at stake is what modernity has learned to its peril, namely that when we lose nature to the senses, we not only lose God, but we lose ourselves as well. If the mountains die, where will our imaginations wander? If the far mesas are leveled, what will sustain us in our quest to be larger than life? If the high valley is made mundane by self-seekers and careless users, where will we find another landscape so eager to nourish our love? And if the long-time people of this wonderful country are carelessly squandered by progress, who will guide us to a better world? Well, what are your thoughts about darkness?
Yeah. Now, one of the marvelous things about darkness to me is it's the only thing that makes it possible to live on the planet.
How so?
If we didn't have darkness,
yeah.
If one side of the globe would be unbearable and the other would be unbearably cold.
Yeah, that's right.
It evens things out for us.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was thinking the other way that we talked about earlier, about all new life coming from the darkness, but now you've got the rotation of the planet that utterly depends upon it. Yeah.
As I was growing up, when I hit a frustrating part, or my mom would say, it's always dark before dawn.
Uh-huh.
So thinking darkness is very much heralding or proclaiming.
Yeah.
Or for anything.
Yeah. Anticipation, prelude. Yeah. And a necessary part of that rhythm, too. Yeah.
The spirits come out in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that are unseen can be seen in the dark, the things that aren't flesh or
mm-hmm.
are made of atoms, can see those and talk to them sometimes more clearly in the dark. And the other world beyond which we're walking, where it's hard to describe, comes out in the dark.
Yeah. Yeah. There are presences which we don't see or catch with the distractions of the busy, light-filled world. Yeah. Souls see best in the dark. Please.
Well, this kind of goes along with what Knut said, but we would not understand life if there was not darkness.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And perhaps this parallel is not correct, but one might also say that we would not understand light. If you, in my way of thinking, I still associate darkness with death,
mm-hmm.
but a parallel being, we would not understand light if we did not have the contrast of death either.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not perhaps it is not necessarily bad to associate darkness with death.
Mm-hmm. But that's an association of death with a pattern mm-hmm. of life, so to speak. I mean, there's a yin and a yang character.
Mm-hmm.
The two together are the both are required.
Absolutely.
In a harmony of the whole. Here and then. Chris.
Along that line, Gandhi says sorrow marries us to God.
Mm.
Likewise, many of us find it helpful to close our eyes when we pray.
Yeah.
And somehow, Jesus is the light of the world only if we are in the darkness. Or I think of the woman who became blind and said, I no longer want to live. And then I think of this 95-year-old pastor who became blind. And he said, I'm having the time of my life. I spend my days making pastoral calls by telephone.
Mm-hmm. So, and probably showing some folks to their apartment when they need some help. Chris?
I have two things. One leads into the second.
Mm-hmm.
First leads into the second. The first is I was thinking about cooking and food.
Cooking,
and
yeah.
Cold and trying to be more helpful in the way that it does. So using unbleached flour, and that got me rolling and thinking about the richness of many foods and the kind of cleansing processes that happen, bleaching and purifying, that make sugar white or make molasses light or make flour white, and how
right.
that process kind of takes out some of the richness of the nutrients in the food that's good for us. But there's also cultural associations that get laid on, value judgments that get laid on those things, which leads me to my second comment about darkness. And that what you're trying to do seems to me also a very political statement in a country like this, and using
yes.
Langston Hughes' poem
yeah.
Brings that out a little bit, because
yeah.
he says black like me.
Right.
And it's very clear that there are cultural assumptions in this country about black and white, and if you look at dictionary definitions,
yeah.
the starting place is really clear.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Mm-hmm.
it's not quite as explicit as the Black is Beautiful movement in the 70s, but the exploring the gifts of darkness, I think, has a very important justice
yeah.
dimension to it.
Yeah, and I will share some of that with investors tomorrow night, and there's more of it in the book if anybody needs it. No, that's my point about, because we get the symbols wrong, we get reality wrong. And the way in which we've associated black and white being pure and good, black being inferior and bad or negative connotations, plays over into racism, straight and simple, just like that. I mean, first of all, it ain't true. That's why I say we don't get reality right. White folks aren't white unless they're pale as a sheet and close to death. And black folks aren't black. I mean, there are a few Nigerians that are, but most are not. And yet, whole ranges of connotations follow from white and black as symbols that have. Well, we know what some of the outcomes.
White folk want to get brown.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The bell is going to ring. Please go ahead, and then we'll finish.
How do we talk about those powers that wish to destroy us, though, and the fact that there is something at work sometimes in our very selves that is destructive?
Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of language do?
Yeah.
We
use? Well, I think we also use a range of of symbols, metaphors, images, etc., one of which is the dark side or something.
People talk about our shadow.
Yeah, our shadow. I mean, my opposition isn't to the use of language for that. Mm-hmm. It's the exclusive negative images attached to dark. I think, as with God language, one needs a wide range in order to get at the varied dimensions of those things. So there is, to me, to talk about the shadow side or the dark side, or to talk in terms of death, which is, can have, as we've already seen, also different dimensions to it, is a proper use of language. But it isn't enough if it's only leveled there, just as only one image of God is not sufficient to speak of the dimensions of divinity. Yeah. So this isn't a protest against some of the uses of darkness. It's against the exclusive attention to it. When it becomes a symbol that denies other realities that we also know. I mean, we heard in the discussion tonight all sorts of positive connotations with darkness. That is our reality. And yet we can deny that with the very language that we use and the images we use. We just aren't receptive to it when we do that. That's why getting the symbols wrong often doesn't let the reality itself that we do experience come through. Okay, thanks, folks. See you in a minute.